This episode courtesy of Gretsch Drums and that great Gretsch sound. Visit GretschDrums.com to see the latest gear and sign up for the Gretsch newsletter.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Is drummer right? Is it okay to say drummer?
Pounding his pulsing beat into the hearts of all America.
You motherfuckers are fucking all over this joint.
You do your kind of drumming, and I'll do my kind of drumming.
I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against.
The only things I care about in this goddamn life are me and my drums and you.
The official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You suppose maybe I could put the drums in your place and sort of drop in once in a while?
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Get up there behind those drums, lean back, close your eyes, get right on the groove there, give it a good steady beat.
I got blisters on my fingers!
I'd hit that.
I'm in Austin, Texas, with Tommy Price. Tommy, thank you for joining me today, man.
Yeah, very welcome.
We were talking just outside, fellow New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
You're from, born in Brooklyn?
Born in Brooklyn, raised in Staten Island, and spent my entire life in New York City. Moved into New York City when I was 20 or maybe 21. Yeah, 21 years old. Left Staten Island and was able to afford, you know, a one-bedroom apartment, actually a studio apartment at that time. So, yeah, I went through a little transformation of, you know, Brooklyn, Staten Island, New York City, and just stayed there. That's where I grew up.
Where was that studio apartment?
East Village, East 2nd Street and Avenue B, to be exact.
So what was that like at that point?
Well, it was pretty terrific. It was, you know, everyone wanted to live in the East Village. That's where everything was happening. That's where the punk scene was, all the cool clothing stores. Pretty much everyone that was in a band in them days lived somewhere in the vicinity of the East Village or West Village, somewhere in, you know, in that part of the city. But it was pretty cool. I was walking distance from CBGB's, Max's Kansas City, the Mud Club. They were all very close, you know. Maybe 10 minute cab ride uptown. But yeah, you know, the East Village. And then over the years, of course, it started getting a little more developed, the East Village, and became a little bit more exclusive to live there, a little bit more expensive. And yeah, and everyone, and then of course, the everything changed, you know. Business owners started opening up really great restaurants. It was no longer a seedy part of town. It was no longer called Alphabet City. It was called the East Village. So it was pretty spectacular to, I mean, I lived there up until pretty much I moved here to San Antonio.
Same apartment or same?
Well,
area?
I moved around the area a little bit, you know, a couple of blocks away. I found a different apartment, a little bit bigger apartment. You know, then I was able to buy an apartment, and in 1984, and so I bought. One of my, I bought something about a co-op on East 10th Street, and I had that for a few years. So, you know, I moved around quite a bit and wound up in, right before I moved to Texas, I wound up in Gramercy Park.
Nice.
Which was very nice.
Key to
I
the
loved
park?
It. Didn't have a key to the park, but, you know, you didn't really need one anyway. You know, people used to walk around there. But yeah, once I was settled in my life as far as being married and having a child and raising a kid in New York City, I needed to get out of the East Village and move somewhere a little bit safer and a little bit more, you know, a little bit nicer. So Gramercy Park, I was able to slip into, and took a little while, you know, because you have to have a committee of people letting you in, and it's the same shit in New York City, you know. They need to accept you into their fold, as they say, you know. So, and they did, you know. They knew that I had an income and I had a job, and I was respectful, so, you know, sort of. You know, but little did they know, and we won't get into that.
What year was it when you got there to the East Village from Staten Island?
Well, it wasn't a direct
move
route from Staten Island to the East Village. It was, I went through, Soho. I had sublet for a summer, just so I can get a vibe. I went from Staten Island to Soho, but it wasn't the Soho
know. This is back when it was nothing.
Exactly. It was just factories.
People should check out the movie After Hours.
There you go. That's it.
And yeah. That was Soho. Yeah.
Factories, you know, just like the meatpacking district. You know, back then it was meat trucks delivering meat to factories, you know. But now it's like, you know, everyone wants an apartment in the meatpacking district. So it was like that. It was Soho.
No business, yeah.
Soho wasn't Soho. It was just
It was what do you want to go there for?
Exactly. Why would you want? But it was a sublet for me, just for a summer, so I can make the transformation from Staten Island into Soho. And then from there, then I got the vibe of New York City a little bit and was able to make enough money to buy an apartment, right. You know. And so it was kind of a stepping stone kind of thing, you know. I held on to the co-op that I bought, but rented an apartment around the corner because it was just a small, it was right near NYU University, New York University. So I rented it to a bunch of students, you know. I bought it for an investment, rented to students, and made a little bit of money on it, sold it. But lived in other places. So I kind of scattered. I'm a typical, New Yorker, you know. No one really stays in one spot too long. You know, I'm like a gypsy. You know, I live in one place for a little time and kind of get tired of it, so I, you know. But luckily, the East Village apartment I got pretty cheap at the time, and managed to hold on to that I stayed there in any of my apartments 14 years, you know, in the East 2nd Street apartment. And to this day, I wish I would have held on to that place, but the landlord wouldn't let me sublet it. You know, it was, everyone was doing illegal sublets. So, but anyway, all my apartments are in the city. We're all in pretty much the same radius. You know, even Gramercy Park wasn't far from the East Village. You could walk there in 10, 15 minutes. Yeah. You know, yeah. a good stroll.
Yeah.
You get to the East Village in 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah. It's all very convenient.
Yep.
What was the plan when you got to the city? You're 20, 21. Was it, you're going to be a drummer? Was that it?
Well, yeah, I already knew I was going to be a drummer. That's what got me off Staten Island. I wouldn't have if I wasn't able to afford my own place, I wouldn't have left Staten Island because it was cheap to live out there. It was because I was already making money playing drums. While I was living on Staten Island.
In the city, were you doing gigs?
Absolutely. I was already touring. I was touring with Mink DeVille by then.
Okay, so yeah, let's walk me through this. When, so what happens, what's the first big gig you get?
was, well, actually the first big gig in my eyes was a group called Flame on RCA Records. That's when I met Jimmy Iovine.
And so how old are you at this point?
18, 19.
Okay. And so an audition kind of situation?
I went for an audition for Meatloaf. He had just, well, not even released the very first Bat Out of Hell record.
So it was prior to the release, but he'd recorded it?
It was already in the can, and the bass player, who I grew up with, that played on the record is Kazem Sultan, who's one of the very first musicians I met on Staten Island when I moved there from Brooklyn. So Kazem used to play with Todd Rundgren's Utopia. Right, he was one of the members in Utopia. We were the same age, Kazem and I. He said, well, you know, we just played on this record. This guy Meatloaf, is putting a band together to tour because they're releasing this record that I just played on. You should go up for the audition. So I went up to New York City, learned a few songs, went up to New York, Lafayette Street. I remember the same studio. It was called Star Rehearsal on Lafayette Street, where I auditioned for Meatloaf. And did the audition, and went great. And so I'm getting ready to leave, and this guy walks up to me, and he says, you should audition for this other band that I manage. And I've been producing. They're called Flame. They're from Brooklyn, New York. They released one record prior to the one they just released one record, and it's called Queen of the Neighborhood. And you should listen to it and come up and audition. He said it's suited more for your drumming than Meatloaf, right? Now, this band Flame happened to be sharing a loft space with Meatloaf to rehearse. So I went up, I learned the songs, went up and auditioned, and the music was totally different. Flame was rock and roll music. It was, you know, more of what, you know, I thought I should be doing. They wanted me in the band. And plus, Meatloaf was just crazy music to me. It was like that Bat Out of Hell record was all over the place, and it was more theatrical than the rock and roll I wanted to do. And so I kind of had a choice, and I went with Flame. But it was a good move for me because, first of all, it was the first big tour I ever did. You know, we went out with Bob Seger, and you know, we opened up for a small tour. The record didn't really go anywhere. We had one single called Beg Me, and it was a cover of an old song, but Jimmy Iovine produced it. And even though he was nobody in them days, later on he started using me on other things. He started calling me and using me on other records. He was a New Yorker. He was a staff producer at the record plant, that's the place where everyone made their records, either the Electric Lady or the record plant, you know, or media. But Jimmy happened to do all his records at the record plant. And so I kind of got under his fold, and he used me on a bunch of records, like the Motors from England, D.L. Byron, I was on Epic Records, I can't remember what else he used, but Jimmy and I always kind of, he always used me for certain things, and it was a good name to have under my belt, you know, after the fact. And then he did, of course, Damn the Torpedoes, you know, Born to Run, Stevie Nicks. I mean, the guy just blew up. So, you know, it was good. And then he liked me. You know, he was...
You were friends as well?
We were friends. And then all the people that were on his staff, like Tom Penunzio, great engineer, all the people at the record plant, you know, it was around the early days of the 80s, and those big records were still getting made there, the same studio. People would run into each other at the same place. But, that's how I, that was kind of my first taste. Flame was my big first taste. After that, the band kind of dissolved. We got dropped from RCA Records.
Is this like all within a year?
This is all within maybe not even a year. Okay. Maybe 8 months. It was everything went really, really fast. You know, we recorded a record. We did a small tour.
And Jimmy Iovine produced the record.
Yes, yeah. Jimmy Iovine produced that record. Yeah. It was just entitled Flame.
Guessing you worked pretty quick back then.
Yeah, back then
you
we all recorded.
Tracks done.
All the tracks were done, maybe even in 2 days, maybe, you
so
know.
So he saw how quick and efficient
Yeah. Them days, you know, you went in as a band, you know, recorded. You went into rehearsal first, got the songs really, really tight, went straight into the studio, recorded. Sometimes we do half of the record in one day, you know. I mean, we bang them out, you know, 3, 4, 5 takes each song, and at the end of the day, we'd have almost a complete record. And then they come in over the, you know, 2-week, 3-week period to do overdubs, singing, background vocals, hand, you know, whatever. And you know, in a month, you'll have a new record, a brand new record.
So so you're saying after, let's say, the 8.5 months, whatever it is, you break up,
yeah,
but Jimmy keeps calling you in for recording sessions.
That's right. He'd call me in to do other work on other records.
And can I ask you, what's the pay like back then for something like that? I mean, do you remember?
You know, I can't really remember. You know, I think I was taking whatever they offered me because I was still trying to, you know, get up the ladder. I wasn't going to refuse anything or be...
It depended on the budget.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, if it was Jimmy Iovine involved, it wouldn't be a bad budget. That's for sure. You know, he would have, you know, he would... I don't know. I can't remember.
He took
remember.
Care of you, though.
Let's he just, took care of me, yeah.
You're that's making real money. You're a young guy, but you're making real money.
Well, of course. And that's how I managed to get, you know, my ass out of Staten Island going to the city, you know. But, yeah, and that was probably right before I got a call from a friend of mine who told me that Willie DeVille had just moved to New York City. And I was looking to put a new band together.
Where did he move from?
I think California.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he was living in San Francisco.
Okay. Yep. So you knew him as Willie?
What, Willie DeVille?
No, I didn't know Mink. Yeah. I didn't know.
Yeah, well, Mink DeVille was his band. Willie is his name.
Right, okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what happened? You didn't know him. There's a mutual friend. He's in town, wants to put a band together.
Mm-hmm.
You get introduced? Is it like a meeting? How's it?
No, it wasn't even a meeting. It was a phone call, not even from him, but from his so-called manager, and asked me to come in and try and help Willie put a band together or try and help him find musicians. And I did. They might have sent me some songs or not. I can't remember. I don't think back then that people were sending songs around, like emailing. So it was, come in, we'll play the songs, you know, and see what you think. And it was at a club. They happened to be a friend of the people that own this club called Trax. On 79th.
Next, right?
Yeah,
Trax. Right.
Yeah. Well, they happen to know the people that either owned it or worked there, but that's what we rehearsed, you know, because they had like a lot of money to go into SIR to rehearse. So they were doing us a favor by letting us use the place to rehearse. And that's where we put his band together. We found some musicians, and I fell in love with the music, like automatically. You know, no one had to convince me to do anything. And he already had a European tour booked. He had just released his second record, the one with This Must Be the Night on it.
Is that the one with Spanish Stroll?
No. That was the one before that.
Okay.
That was Cabretta.
Okay.
Yeah, Spanish Stroll. But this was the next one with This Must Be the Night. It was an incredible record. And I fell in love with it. And, Willie was so charming, and he was,
Yeah, tell me more about him.
Great.
What was he like as far as...
You had to really know him to appreciate him. He was one of these guys that had... everything he did and wrote was from his heart. You know, you could tell he wore his heart on his sleeve, so they say. So he's one of these guys, but his songwriting was pretty incredible. I grew up on soul music, on Blue Eyed Soul, Righteous Brothers, and Dave Clark Five and the Young Rascals. So when I was a kid, that's the music that I loved. So later on, when I met Willie DeVille, he was playing for me all of this Cajun music and this old, dub reggae, something really, really that touched my soul. And especially the doo-wop music he used to play. Just hanging out, he put on some, Dion and the Belmonts or fucking great music. It was just blew me away, and I wanted to be around this guy. I just wanted to be a part of his music. And so that's what really sold me on that. And I helped him put this little band together. He already had a keyboard player, Kenny Margolis, had already been playing with him for a while.
Is that the brother of Bob?
No. But so then Willie got dropped from Capitol Records, and we put this great band together and did a showcase at remember the Savoy? If you're from New York, the Savoy. We did a showcase at the Savoy Theater.
Well, just the word showcase alone, by the way.
I'm dating myself.
I remember showcases, yeah. But I mean...
Well, that's what you did back then.
That's
you had a showcase.
Yeah.
You had to present yourself and sell the people. And it happened to be Ahmet Erdogan in the crowd. He fell in love with Willie too, and signed him that night to Atlantic Records. Yeah.
So what was Ahmet Erdogan like?
It's pretty amazing. He's this big guy, bigger than life figure that walks in the room. It's like,
Did you know who he was prior to that?
Sure. I've read his name and things. Ahmet Erdogan. He ran Atlantic Records, so yeah. But we blew him away. He fell in love with Willie, and we got signed to Atlantic Records that night. And the next couple of records we did on Atlantic Records, we had Jack Nietzsche come back and produce us.
What's Jack Nietzsche like, man? There you go. There's the guy.
He's kind of wild. We found him under the console one day and, talking about the devil and stuff. So he was a little wild.
Would that have been LSD or mushrooms?
I have no idea, and I'm not going to say. I don't know.
No, because they're an amazing career.
I have no
idea. Jack Nietzsche, that's quite a career right there.
Yeah.
To work with a guy like that. Did you enjoy working with him besides being under the console?
He wasn't in the console the whole time we recorded.
No, I'm saying, did you enjoy working with him?
Of course I did. Yeah, of course. Him and Willie... I think the Spanish Stroll records, that first record, Jack did. He might even did another one, but so they were kind of a team. They have worked together before, they had a chemistry the two of them, Willie DeVille and Jack. And so just to watch them in the studio feed off each other and bounce ideas, vocal ideas. Jack was incredible at doing string arrangements, you know, and he would use real strings too. He wouldn't fuck around with synthesizers. He had a straight hire a string section for, you know, yeah, he was the real deal, man, that guy.
Oh, yeah.
As you know, and I was still very young and impressionable back then, so I was soaking all this stuff up, and I was in awe of these two people.
Yeah, I mean, so wait, what was the age difference between you and Willie?
There was a little bit of an age difference. I think Willie was closer to my brother's age, probably almost 10 years older than me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And Jack Nietzsche is what, like 20 years older?
At least, okay. Than me.
Right.
So 10 years more than Willie.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah, more like that.
Right, so you're the kid of the band?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just soaking it in, as you said.
Soaking it in at a young age. And then we got a chance to tour Europe. I mean, it was I didn't even have a passport yet, so I had to apply for a passport and go through all of that bullshit, and that was my first big, like, leaving home, overseas tour, and we went everywhere with that band, all over. That band was bigger in Europe and Scandinavia. Than we were in the States, you know. It's like the Ramones. The Ramones really didn't do big business in the States, but they can go to Europe and half the year, you know, sell out, you know, great halls.
Yeah, and playing football stadiums in South America. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then they play Coney Island High.
Yeah, and then they come back and they can just about sell out Seabees, you know.
I know.
That's crazy.
I know. All right, so, okay, yeah, so you did the tour of Europe. What happens after that? You didn't continue, or?
Well, Mink DeVille continued up to a couple of years ago until Willie died, but I left the band.
After that?
Not after that. We did a bunch of tours. I was with Mink DeVille for, let's see, from 77 or 78 to 82.
Mm-hmm.
So I played, yeah, we did, you know, a bunch of tours and then I did some records in Germany with an artist called Helen Schneider. So I was doing a little bit of work with other records in between Mink DeVille and Scandal. And the Scandal, I think, was 1981. I made a change around 81. I left Mink DeVille, 81 or 82, something like that. And
were you just tired of it? You want something different?
Well, no. I needed, you know, I was kind of making a name for myself. And Mink DeVille was just right here and wouldn't go any further. It stopped at one point as far as what I thought I could do. And then I needed to get to the next level. And so I was approached by some friends, and they had lost their drummer. And I kind of went down, the same kind of thing, you know, slipped in, learned some songs, met Patty Smythe and Zach Smith from Scandal. Played me some songs. They already had an MTV, one of the very first MTV videos called Goodbye to You.
Huge.
Yeah. And so I think maybe John Bon Jovi might have been playing bass guitar or something in the video, or one of the videos for that. I think it was Goodbye to You. So they didn't really have a band. It was just Patty and Zach. And so they had this radio-ready song called Goodbye to You that was getting tons of airplay. They did shot a little video in someone's basement, and all of a sudden it was one of the first ones on MTV. And so they needed to do a tour, put a band together and do a tour. Just like Meek DeVille. Same kind of formula, right? But, but by the time I got in there, the band was already formed. All they needed was a drummer. And I rehearsed with them, and we went on the road for about a year. And these are the days you needed to break a record on the road. In order for the record to get any kind of notice, you had to support whatever band your agency put you on, whatever band your agency, you know, told you to go support. And we started with, I think, the Boomtown Rats. Then we did John Cougar Mellencamp. Then we did Adam and the Ants. Then we did Duran Duran. Then we did Hall & Oates. Yeah, everybody that had new records.
These are the huge stars of the 80s, by the way.
Exactly. And so we opened for all of them for about a year without coming back home. So, we wanted to just go home for a week, but they wouldn't let us because we were doing good business on the road. It was working out for them, keeping Scandal on the road, you know, and the headliners happened to like us, you know. So by the time we came off the road, we were ripe, man. We were fucking, you know, we were just exhausted. It was about a year. It was about 11 or 12 months straight without coming home.
You paying that rent on that studio?
Yeah, and by then, we had the Goodbye to You thing was all over MTV, and we were even playing new songs in our set. By the end of the tour, we already had songs prepared for the next record. And that's when we came off the road. I think we had a week off or a week and a half. And I went to Puerto Rico for 2 days, I think, and came back, went straight into the studio, Electric Lady, and started recording the Warrior album.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, another huge hit.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
Probably still hear that at the supermarket.
Oh, yeah, I do.
There it is.
Yeah.
So that was like maybe, was that, yeah, I guess that would have been your first big song, right?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that was the first top 40 song, at least. Top 20 or top 40, something like that.
Yeah.
It was only a week on the radio before Rebel Yell came out, which is my second.
Okay, so yeah, let's get to, so hold on. Yeah, yeah. So you record that, the Scandal thing. You're still in the band.
Yeah.
And then how does the Billy Idol thing come up?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that. Cuz I get asked it all the time.
I know.
But it's a good one. Hey, when we went into Electric Lady to Electric Ladyland Studios to do the Warrior record, we were recording it at Studio A downstairs. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but Billy was recording Rebel Yell upstairs in Studio B, you know, and they were having trouble going through drummers. They couldn't find the right drummer to play on the songs. They had already pre-recorded some stuff, and Keith Forsey, Steve Stevens, and Billy Idol weren't happy with any of the drummers that they were hearing on the songs. So Billy and Steve happened to be sitting in the lobby one day, and I was in Studio A playing, and they just happened to ask the engineer who the drummer was on the record that was being cut. And they told him, and he said, well, you know, if he's got a couple of minutes, ask Tommy to come upstairs. And I did, you know, not knowing who the fuck was up there or where I was going. And I opened the door, Keith Forsey is sitting in the seat, Michael Frondelli, the engineer, who's an old friend of mine, Steve and Billy. And They started playing me some stuff. They asked me to, would you mind trying to play on a couple of tracks? I said, sure. So I was listening to it, and the first song I think was Do Not Stand in the Shadows. Ran downstairs, got my pink snare drum, brought it upstairs. Because they already had kits set up. All they needed was a good snare drum, so.
Was that a premiere?
Yeah, of course. And so, you know, just ran up there with my snare drum. I don't think I even listened to the song twice. They put some headphones on and played it. I think the second song I cut was Rebel Yell. The song Rebel Yell. Yeah, and then for the next month, I would go upstairs and downstairs with my pink snare drum doing both records.
Same time.
At the same time. And both records were released the same year.
So did you know, I mean, I know this is an old thing where guys say, oh, this is going to be a huge hit, and then, of course, nothing happens. And then the opposite is true. You go, and becomes a massive hit. Yeah. Did you have any idea?
Absolutely none. I mean, none of the records I did back then, I had, you know, I was working. I was a working drummer. I didn't care. I mean, a lot of the stuff I liked. If people wouldn't hire me to come in and play on a jazz record, they knew what they were asking me to do. They knew what I did best, and that's the stuff I did best, you know. So, yeah, it was kind of an easy fit. But when I heard Billy's music, there was yet another one of them moments in my life, like Mink DeVille, you know, where I thought, yeah, this is something I can sink my teeth into.
Right.
This is for real. This is, that's why it didn't take me long to do them tracks, because I felt them. They were just right up my fucking alley, you know?
Yeah. Were you aware of Generation X, by the way?
Of course.
I didn't know. Like, when you walk in that room, you knew who he was.
Well, sure.
Okay. I don't know, you know.
Okay. No, yeah, no, I knew.
Okay.
You know, but I didn't know who was up there. You know, I mean, when they asked, you know, send Tommy upstairs, I didn't know who I was going to walk into.
But wasn't that always a thing for you when you recall, like, say, Iovine or whoever, they called you in for a session? Wouldn't that be the standard? Like, they don't tell you who it is, or is that not necessarily?
Yeah, no, they tell me. No, I pretty much know, you know, what I'm getting involved with. I mean, like I said, they're not going to ask me to do it if it's not something that they already know me for, right. Or, you know.
It's got to be in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, sort of. A little bit. Yeah.
All right, so that happens. You're saying you spend that time, the month, recording both records. What's the next thing for you? Are you still like, well, I'm in Scandal.
Yeah. Well, this is where it gets tricky.
It's got to get tricky at some point, right?
Yeah. This is where a wrench gets thrown into it. Because for the year and a half that I spent with that band, with Scandal, living with them people on the road and loving them and being as a family, getting to know them and helping them with this next big record, I was in the market of trying to get, you know, a little piece of the band, something. I wanted a piece of the pie. I wanted to make a bit of, if they sell a record, I want to get a piece of that, you know, and they wouldn't give it to me.
You were treating you like a sideman?
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. I was just being paid, you know, weekly and a salary, at, you know, touring, that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, in studio time, whatever I was working for, you know. Now here comes this guy, doesn't know me from Adam, loves what I do on his record, and offers me a piece of his record.
There you go.
What would you do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Very, very simple.
Yeah. And not to mention that I happen to love the fucking vibe, the music, and you know, his songs. So it wasn't a really big decision for me, and I had to make a move.
So once you finish recording Rebel Yell record, I mean, Billy knew, like, you're okay, you're the guy. Here's the offer.
Yep.
We're a band.
Mm-hmm.
Come with me.
That's right.
Very simple.
Yeah.
So I guess soon enough, right, you're off doing that?
They didn't even put my picture on the Scandal record when it was released. That's how pissed off they were. I mean, they put my credit on the album.
There was a band picture or a single
Well,
pictures?
On the back of the cover, there was the band members.
Oh, I see.
And there was a box with nothing, just Tommy Price. No picture. Everyone had, like, class pictures.
Right, the yearbook photo.
Yeah, no. Mine was a big question mark.
Tommy didn't show up for picture day.
Tommy was sick this day.
Right, right.
But we have a hall pass.
Oh, Patty Smythe.
Come on. Yeah. So they were pretty upset with me. But, hey, man, you know.
Oh, they were upset that you left?
Yeah.
After how they... Okay.
Hey, yep.
Well, that's on them.
Yeah. And then we did this whole... Yeah, what is it? 21 years later, VH1 calls Scandal, the band, to do a VH1 band. Remember that thing, Bands Reunited?
Yeah.
Well, we did one in 2006 or 2004. 2006, I think it was. And we did one. We went out to L.A. I hope they got the band back together to do one show at SIR. Had an outside audience come in, paid seats, and we did a whole big interview thing. And sitting around doing the interview with the band, nobody can remember why I left the band. All of a sudden. Oh boy, we don't know.
Memory lapse.
I remember Patty and Zach looking at each other and going, how did that go down? How did that happen? Why did Tommy leave? And I think at one point Patty says, now I remember it. She got into it. But,
oh, okay, okay, yeah. Okay. But was it nice being with them at that point?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was. We had a great show. It was incredible to see them guys again after 22 years, 21 years. And it was fun. It was big fun. We, you know, it was great.
Yeah.
So no hard feelings. We walked away.
Right.
We said, see you later. See you in another 20 years.
Right. Okay. So you hit the road with Billy Idol, right? So that's where we are now. That's what you do. And that must have been another year on the road?
No. Probably in the long run it was, but we were, the record hadn't come out yet, and Billy had a college tour booked and clubs. We were all on one bus, band and crew, about 15 people. We were all crammed up, and, you know, we were playing small gigs. We were playing colleges and small clubs. And while we were on the road, we were kind of a couple of months into doing these gigs. The record gets released and immediately goes on MTV. Oh, no, not MTV. All the radio stations first picked it up. And so we kind of, that record kind of broke while we were touring. So along the way, you could see how well the record was doing because all of a sudden we got another tour bus. All of a sudden, you know, we got better hotels. All of a sudden we're doing arenas instead of colleges. And then we got our own, you know, Heart of Sound and Light Comp. I mean, then it was like five tour buses, you know, three semis, full blown. Rebel Yell was like blown up all over the world. So yeah, we stayed on the road, but we'd go back home. We'd go back to New York for a little bit, you know, take a breath and then go back. You know, they didn't keep us on the road. Although that record did break on the road, we go, you know, in and out. But yeah, then we go overseas, you know, Australia and New Zealand, and pick up a big production there. And you know, Billy had, you know, at one point, it got big. It got like
You know? Now, again, back to the 80s, MTV.
Right, massive. And he was everywhere on MTV. You know, we had done the Rebel Yell video. We had gone, we were still on the road. We had gone back to New Jersey, I think it was. We shot at the Capitol Theater in Passaic, New Jersey, the Rebel Yell video. And yeah, and then it blew up. We were back on the road, and then it was even bigger. You know, it was, yeah, it was most of the 80s. It was just, Billy was MTV.
Hells yeah.
Yeah.
And you, did you enjoy being with the band on the road?
You've for
got,
sure.
You got along with all of them? And
for sure, man. That's you know, cool. It was...
felt like a band.
It was, it, yeah, well, yeah, it was Billy, but we felt, at least we were treated like, you know, good.
As the levels rose, as you were explaining.
Yeah.
The
sure.
Sure, yeah, it yeah, always going up.
Yep, yep, yep. We never got treated like, you know, Billy's up here and the band's down here. We were, Billy hung out with us. He partied with us. He, you know, went out to dinner with us. He didn't keep himself on a pedestal. He was just one of the guys, man. And it was nice to be around that, you know.
Yeah. And at this point, are you still on Iovine's radar? Is he watching? Is he
following? Nah, by then, I think, well, he's still, I don't think he moved to California by that yet, but I might have been, but he was already doing other business.
Okay. You're not getting called in for sessions?
No. Okay. Not by then, no. No.
Are you getting called for sessions?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you kidding? That was what did it, was those two records, was Rebel Yell and The Warrior. And then after that...
So whenever you're in New York, the phone's ringing and it's...
Constantly.
Yeah.
My calendar was filled every day. You know, it wasn't either Debbie Harry or John Waite or Peter Wolf or, you know, some... I was getting hired to do pretty much every important record that was being made in New York back then.
And then for you, like you said, you were just a working drummer.
That's all, yeah. That's
sure,
all
I'll show up, yeah. Just say yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were there any of these people that you didn't know, or you, it was always people that...
I didn't know any of them.
You didn't know any.
I mean, I knew who they were.
You knew who Debbie Harry is, but like a John Waite?
Yeah. I mean, I would meet them on the spot.
Right.
You know, I'd meet them at when I went.
Right.
I would usually meet the producers first. They were the ones that wanted to know me, you know, whoever's producing the records. But the artists, of course, wanted to, you know, they wanted to like it. They needed to like it, too. But, you know, the producer usually has a whole say in back then, at least, you know. Mm-hmm.
If we could go back to then, do you remember if you had a preference at that time? Like, did you prefer studio work or touring?
Back then, it was all about touring. Back, you know, I always loved being in the studio making records. You know, that was always the interesting part. But you know, every musician wants to get out there and play in front of people. They want to show themselves off. That's what we do. You know, we're gluttons like that. We love that shit.
So you need both.
You need both. You feed off that. Gives you confidence.
It couldn't have just been like that studio session.
No. That would have never satisfied me. I needed confidence. I needed people to tell me I'm good. Not just, the people behind the curtain, you know?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So you're with Billy Idol Band. How long does this go for, by the way?
Well, until 1989.
Yeah.
The last tour I did with him was in New Zealand, Australia, in 1989. I came off the road in 1989 with him. I was working with Joan Jett in between all of that too, making her records.
So let's back up.
Yeah.
So you're in New York, and same thing. It starts as a session call.
No.
Okay.
Now this is a little more complicated because I've known her partner Kenny Laguna. I've known from when I was like 17 years old.
From Staten Island or from the city?
No. He from Staten Island, but he was sent from the city. I had made some demos with this kid on Staten Island in his basement playing drums. And he had gotten a publishing deal or production deal through a management called Lieber Krebs. Steve Lieber and David Krebs. I used to manage Aerosmith, Ted Nugent. And so they signed this kid to this production deal, gave him a little bit of money to put some equipment in his house to make three songs, to make a demo, you know. 17 years old, his kid's writing in his basement. So they invested a tiny bit of money in this kid, and Kenny Laguna happened to be sharing an office space with Lieber Krebs when he was managing Joan. And they asked Kenny, can you please do us a favor and go out to Staten Island and produce three songs for this kid because he needs some direction. You know, that's how I met Kenny Laguna. Came out to Staten Island, heard me play on these demos, and always remembered me. So by the time, fast forward to Joan Jett putting the Black Hearts together, Kenny calls me. It was 1981 or something like that. No, it was before that, because I had just gotten the Mink DeVille gig. And he says, come up and audition for this girl. She's from the Runaways. I'm putting a band around her, and you should come up and play. And I did. I learned Bad Reputation and something else, Cherry Bomb maybe. And I loved it. I fell in love with it. It was great. But the night before, I had gotten a call to go to Europe with Mink DeVille. And I already had told them, you know, I was already getting my passport in the works, and maybe a couple of days before, but it was, you know, it was right before the Joan Jett thing, and I just wanted to do it for Kenny and just check it out for him. So, I had to turn it down. He was putting the Black Hearts together. I had to turn that gig down. But I kept in touch with him over the years. And in 1985, he calls me back, and he says, Joan is doing a movie with Michael J. Fox, and we need a drummer to do the soundtrack. It's called Light of Day, that Bruce Springsteen wrote the song. And
I remember them with Paul Schrader.
That's right, Paul Schrader. That's right. So I said, of course. And I went out to California, did that Light of Day soundtrack.
And is Paul Schrader there, by the way, for any of this?
At this, no.
Just curious.
Okay. But it was Jimmy Iovine's studio. We did it at A&M Studios that Jimmy had just bought. It's the old, what's his name, Charlie Chaplin studio.
Right.
A&M Studios in L.A. And Jimmy had bought it and turned it into a recording studio. And he had Shelly Yackas there and all these great engineers, you know. I think Jimmy might have even produced the song Light of Day that Bruce wrote for Joan. So, yeah, and so I did that record, and from there on...
And just to be clear, you're still in Billy Idol Band at this point?
Yes, yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah. For sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, we were probably on hiatus for a little while. But yeah, I was still working with Billy, still doing tours, you know. I think we had just by then put out the Whiplash Smile album.
Yeah.
So we were still touring for that, and we were still going. But from 85 on, after the Light of Day movie came out, they had lost their drummer. And so Joan, you know, would call me in to do her records after that. They'd have different drummers to tour, but they called me in to do her records. I play on her records. And I did. And from there on, I made all her records up until a couple of years ago. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, but so toured with her, too. I toured, you know, whenever I was off with Billy, I would try and stay busy and stay on the road with Joan, because she was constantly touring. She would do a record, a tour. She was like, it was a machine, the way that organization worked. They kept her working all the time, and I loved it. It was great, you know. So whenever Billy was off, I'd be working with her.
So that whole time you're with Billy,
still working with Joan,
right? And, yeah. And how would that work? Just out of curiosity, would there be another drummer on the road, and then when your window is up, they're just like, okay,
that's
thank
right,
you.
Yeah,
it's Tommy
yep.
time.
Yeah,
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 yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
But because I play, you know, they wanted the same drummer on that made the records, and
she
I was
wanted
the,
you.
Yeah,
but
well, yeah. Ultimately, yeah.
Did by the way, was that ever a discussion while you were with Billy? Did she ever try to say like, hey, what can I do to get you? Okay, so let's go back to, you said 89 was the last show, right, yeah. with Billy Idol in Australia?
Mm-hmm. New Zealand.
What happens after that?
Everything goes downhill after that. Goes right in the shitter.
Yeah, but the decade was really good to you.
It was. It was very good to me. Well, part of the 90s was good, too. I mean, Blackheart Records kept me working a little bit, you know. We were doing a lot of weekend one-off shows, they call them, you know. That,
yeah.
Not real full-fledged touring, but we, you know. I kind of liked it at one point because we were able to go home all the time. You know, we'd leave on a Thursday, be home on a Monday kind of thing, or leave on a Friday, be home on a Sunday. We'd have a weekend show and then be able to go home, you know, back to New York.
Right.
And I kind of dug that for a while because I spent my entire life on the road.
Yeah.
So it gave me a little break of constant touring. Plus, by 2008, at 59 years old, I had a kid. I didn't give birth to the kid, but
yeah.
No, actually, I did.
Let's just say you did.
Let's just say I did.
Today's day and age.
Yeah.
But let's just go back though. So 89 stopped. Was there any reason?
I mean, a big reason. Billy had left. Him and Steve had left New York and moved to L.A. So, and they wanted me to go with them. They wanted me to relocate. And I didn't want to leave New York.
And that was a thing? Like, it was like, if you're not here with us?
Well, no. Not back then, I guess it was. But they asked me to. And I was just not, you know, ready to do that. We had come back from New Zealand, Australia. I think Billy's partner, his wife or whatever, happened to be looking at houses in California while we were on the road and found one. So he came off the road, went to L.A. and stayed in L.A. I don't even know if he came back to New York. But and I think only a year or two later, Steve followed. And at one point, one of them asked me to come out there, and I didn't want to go to live in California. I mean, I would go out there to work. I made lots of records out there, but I didn't really want to go out there to live. So I wasn't ready to do that. Plus, I just started getting busy with Joan again, you know, and so. And then my own project, I had my was releasing records on my own. Had my own little band together in the, you know. So, I wasn't ready to really do that.
Was your band doing local gigs?
Well, just local gigs, yeah.
What kind of places were you playing?
Well, we played the Bottom Line, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, I put a record out on CBS Records, CBS Associated Records, with Chasm Salton. And they did a live broadcast on NEW.
WNEW, Scott Muni.
That's right.
Yeah.
We had Allison, was it Allison Steele?
The Nightbird.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think that DJ'd it. And we recorded it live from the Bottom Line. So me and Chasm were doing some gigs locally. I mean, we might have played Philadelphia and a couple of Boston maybe. But we didn't. The record didn't do it. The only thing that happened with that record is that I had a song in a movie. It was called The All Nighter with Susanna Hoffs from the Bangles.
Yeah.
The All Nighter was a kind of surf movie.
Yeah, they tried to make her a movie star. That's
Yeah. Well, they used some of my few of my songs for the movie, and actually shot a video around it. Me in a wetsuit. Me and Kasim in wetsuits. Yeah, trying to surf.
Who's in the band? In your band at that point?
Oh boy, I had a great band, man. I had Tommy Mandel on keyboards. I had Jimmy Clark on drums. Keith Mack on guitar, Kasim playing bass, me playing guitar, Danny Lewis on keyboards. I had what's her name that sings with the Rolling Stones.
Mm. Got me there.
Oh boy, now I'm blanking out. I'll remember her name, but she's one of the background singers that sings, goes on tour with the Stones. Lisa Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa Fisher. Really tall, beautiful girl. Her and another girl, Beverly Hill. That was her name, yeah.
Nice.
They did background singing. But yeah, I had a terrific band. I had two drum sets set up. And then I would switch back and forth playing guitar and singing and playing drums with the other drummer, Jimmy Clark. And it was fabulous. I was getting my rocks off being a frustrated guitar player because I love playing guitar. You know, this is one of my first, the first instruments I picked up.
Oh, okay. See, that's in guitar. Okay, I didn't know. Yeah. All right, so that was the first one.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were playing all through all those years. You were just...
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah. And you liked being a front man. You liked...
Well, I'm a bit of a ham, you know, sometimes. I like doing that. Yeah, I love playing guitar. I love my guitars. I have a beautiful collection of guitars, and besides all my fucking drums I have.
Right. And by the way, so as a drummer, and then when you pick Jimmy Clark...
Yes.
What's going on? Like, in other
well,
words,
he was kind of my protege, this dude, and he lived in New York, and he was part of the scene in New York, but... He was already listening to a lot of records that I played on and kind of carving himself out as a drummer, but played in my style. So I think I knew him from the clubs, you know, and he'd always talk about how, you know, how he dug me and loved to come in and jam more, you know. And I called him when we had to put a band together, me and Kasim. And I called him and he was kind of fit in perfect, yeah.
You felt like, yeah, he does kind of play like me.
Well, kind of, yeah. But you know, he tries to.
Right. But like you said, good enough for you, obviously.
Good enough for me.
Right.
I mean, I used to kick his ass, you know. I mean, you know, if I didn't like what he did, I'd turn around, kick the bass drum or something. But yeah, he was manageable.
Yeah. And he was, like you said, he was younger than you, so he was...
Yeah, a little bit younger than me. He even, in fact... There was a weekend I couldn't play with Joan, and he filled in for me.
Nice.
Yeah, I went out on the road with the Blackhearts and did a great job.
Right. So the 2000s lean years, is that what you were getting at?
Yeah, I would say so. I started developing a bad drug habit. Was, you know, just in a bad place and... Yeah, I was a mess and needed to get my shit together and started selling gear and, you know, going crazy with drugs. And I had to get my shit together. So I had a bit of a struggle around that time.
Mm-hmm. And you're not able to work like that kind, that bad kind.
Well, I was still working, but I was working just to support my drug habit. You know, it was, you know, I was bad because I was living just from check to check. You know, I wasn't able to do much of anything anymore because everything was going up my arm.
Right. Does that start or years prior, and it's just kind of for fun and here?
Yeah. It started a few years prior.
Chipping and yeah.
That's what they call it.
And chipping. Then all of a sudden, it just
blew out,
seemingly out of nowhere. Now we got a problem. So that must have taken time, I'd imagine. That takes time.
It took a lot of time because I was in and out of rehab, and you know, I missed out on lots of stuff that I should have been there for, and I regret it. I mean, to this day, I'm still purchasing back, and lucky to find gear all over New York City that I sold and hawked and traded and, you know, for money. So, you know, Matt will tell you that we're still finding these things, and, like, you know, things that mean a lot to me. Instruments and you know, guitars and drum sets.
You go on eBay and it's like Tommy Price's, like that kind of thing. It's like this belonged to Tommy Price.
Not so much. Not as far as eBay, but, you know, when I sold a lot of my stuff, I knew exactly who I was selling it to, and I knew I was going to be able to get it back if I wanted it.
And they still had it?
And they still had it.
Okay.
So.
Now that's cool.
I mean, I sold a few things where I can't get back, like hawk shops and.
Sure.
Who knows where that stuff is, you know, but.
Sure.
I knew where it was going, and I always told them, please, if you ever want to get rid of it, you know, let me know first.
Right.
We'll see if I can still afford it or not. And, you know, and they never did. They just held on to it. And
that's cool.
Yeah,
that
it's
really
amazing.
Cool.
It didn't happen once. It happened like twice.
Right.
Or three times, maybe.
Well, you picked the right people.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
As fucked up as I was, I knew what I was doing. I was smart enough to figure that out.
Isn't that amazing?
I don't know how your brain works, man, but I was lucky enough to pick people. I mean, you know, when you go into shit like that, you don't care who the fuck you know, just give me the money. I don't care who you are. I don't care about shit. You know, I just got to get well right now, you know.
Yeah.
I don't care where it comes from.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but somewhere in the back of my brain, something was telling me, oh, you better know who the fuck you're selling this to, because it's it might kick you in the ass later on. And thank God it didn't.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's great. It worked out. You're able to find all that stuff.
I was just lucky. That's all. I was just lucky.
Yeah. Okay, so you're still in New York, though, at that point, right?
Yeah.
Did you ever consider getting out? I mean, I don't mean New York. I mean of just the biz.
No, I couldn't because I needed to work. I needed to, I mean, once I was involved with drugs, that took over my life. So the only way I can make money, I didn't know how to do anything else. I can only play drums to make money. So I would take whatever work came to me, just to support my drug habit and pay my rent. So, yeah, I didn't care about much. But,
Well, I meant, like, did the idea of, say, touring again, was that a daunting thought because of...
No, well,
once you're clean, in other words, going there, like...
Well, once you're clean, it's different, but I think one of the reasons why I liked how Joan worked was just weekend shows.
Yeah.
I had a lot to do with my drug habit because I knew I'd need to go home sooner or later to get shit.
Right.
I mean, I couldn't stay on the road too long because I'd be physically sick.
You knew how much to bring.
Yep.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'd get stuff sent on the road, but that's tricky because I would read about people getting busted at hotels and FedEx things and
all this
crazy nonsense. And I was getting the same exact things done, you know, having FedEx packages sent on the road. And it was nuts. So, I kind of liked how she was touring because it kept my habit going. But after a while, you just can't fucking do that anymore. It gets in the way of your job sooner or later.
And do they know?
yeah, of course they knew, but they just put up with me, you know? I mean, I, to this day, I don't know how. I mean,
well, because you were functioning probably, right?
I was a functioning addict.
You got on stage, you played.
I was a functioning addict. I was never one to, like, pass out or... It might have happened once, but yeah, I wasn't a sloppy junkie.
Let's put it that way. Yeah, yeah.
I was a very neat junkie.
Mm-hmm. Kept you going.
It kept me alive. I mean, I no longer got high. Mm-hmm. I was just keeping myself normal.
Right.
No one saw me like that.
Right.
You know.
Right. Yeah.
I was just functioning.
Mm-hmm.
I was just being not sick.
Yeah, it was your meds, exactly.
It's my meds.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. I get it. So I'm saying though, when you do clean up, is it scary to think about going on the road for a little bit or being in clubs, that kind of thing? Or?
Not at all. No.
Okay.
No, it doesn't bother me one bit.
Okay.
Not at all.
Yeah.
No.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's a plus.
Yep.
So... we can jump forward. I mean, like you were saying, you're in New York, and it was time for Texas.
Time for Texas.
How does that come up for you? How does it happen?
It hit us really quick because it was the height, the beginning of the pandemic. And my wife is originally from here. This is where I met her 30 years ago.
You met her in Texas?
Yeah, she was born in San Antonio, and I was touring through Texas with Joan Jett. She's a lot younger than me. She's 16 years younger than me. And so she's 18 years old, just got her driver's license, she's a runner for this place called Sneakers that was in San Antonio, club that Joan happened to be playing at. We were in town. She was delivering something to Joan at the hotel from the promoter, maybe her dry cleaning or something, Joan's dry cleaning, something. And I met her in the elevator, literally in the elevator. I was going to sound check. And I was, I had to go there early for some reason. So I needed a ride. I was gonna probably go down to the lobby, wait for a taxi. And she says, well, I work for the promoter. I'll give you a ride there. That's how I met my wife. But, that's how I met her, Stephanie, that one time. Over the years, we always kept in touch. Whenever I came to Texas, if she came to New York City, we'd always hook up. We'd always spend, you know, a few days together. And so, yeah, she moved to New York a bunch of years later, moves to Connecticut with her sister, and we start getting in touch again. And she says, I'm coming to New York City tonight. I'm living in Connecticut now. I was blown away. I was in between wives. And I said, come on in, girl. And I just happened to be free. And from that night, she never went back to Connecticut. She stayed in my apartment. We had a kid. And anyway, pandemic hit. First of all, wait, let's back up a little bit. In 2016, I get diagnosed with cancer. And so it took me off the road, okay? And so I'm out of work now. From 2016, I couldn't tour anymore. I was going through surgery, chemo, all this shit. I had a little bit of money saved, all of a sudden the pandemic. I'm out of work for 5 years. We need to leave. You know, we need to get out of New York. We can't really even afford to stay here anymore because, you know, no one's going to be working for a long time. Everything was shut down. There was nothing going on. I had a little bit of money I needed to invest, and if I didn't, it would have went all to my rent in like a year and a half, 2 years.
And this is the end. This is Gramercy Park.
This is Gramercy Park. And we bought a house online. I mean, one of our friends, one of our friends found us a house in San Antonio at a good price. And it was sight unseen. Of course, she sent us pictures. And we knew we weren't going into
it. And at least your wife knows San Antonio.
And she knew San Antonio. She still had family in San Antonio.
She's still going back.
She's going back to something that we already know. And I know, see, I knew San Antonio a little bit. So we knew it was kind of a no-brainer for us, you know. It's not like we were moving to some, you know, another state that neither one of us knew anything or knew anyone. You know, Texas was very familiar to both of us. And like I said, if I didn't do something like that, the money that I had put away would have been gone just in rent. I was out of work already for 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's...
And the rent in Gramercy Park is not cheap. So, you know, that money would have been gone. I would have went right through that. And then right now, today, I'd have been doing dick. Nothing. Maybe a couple of gigs around the city, you know. You know, nothing to support myself that and of my family. That's for shit sure. So I had to make a move and it had to be quick. And I did. And I'm so glad. I would do it another 10 times, the same move. I love where I am.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of a sudden I got another spark up my ass about music again. You know, I see everything a little bit clearer now. And I'm in a really good space today.
It's fun again.
It's fun again. It's fucking fun again.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the key.
Yeah.
I can relate, yes. Yes.
I mean, I don't mind, I do these gigs in Austin here. With Danny B. Harvey and his wife.
Who, by the way, thank you, Danny B., for passing me.
Yes, name. How about that? And happy birthday. It was his birthday yesterday.
Happy birthday, Danny B. Harvey. Look out.
Him and Annie Marie, you know, do these club gigs, and I love doing them. It's like, you know, old rock and roll songs, and, you know, it's just, I have a good time. Drink a couple of beers, have fun, you know, and I leave there and I have fun. I get, you know, it's good. I like doing it again. It's not a job.
Right.
It's not a job anymore. For so many years, it was a fucking struggle. I hated going to work. You know, it was a 9-to-5 for me. And I don't want it. I never got into this business for that. I don't want it to be a 9-to-5. You know, I want to have fun doing what I do, what I love to do.
Yeah.
And for many years I did, and then I lost that. So I'm finding it again.
Yeah. That's the best, I think. That's really the, and you consider doing the road for a while?
I don't know if I'd get that far, but might get up there to, you know, I'm getting the bug again.
Maybe some short runs,
but I don't know about any long touring anymore. I don't, you know, that wore me out. That put years on my life.
Yeah.
Touring, it's not the 90 minutes on stage or the hour and a half or 2 hours on stage. It's everything in between. It's the fucking airports. It's the long drives. It's the waiting around. It's the fucking bad food. All of that kills you. That's what puts years on your life. All of that bullshit. Not the 2 hours on stage. That's a pleasure.
Right. Yeah. You don't pay me for that. Pay me for the, exactly, all the other bullshit.
If musicians got paid for all of the other shit, we'd be fucking rich people.
No, very true. I know you want to plug your at-home recording.
Yes. We're doing projects for my house, Matt and I. You can hire me to do sessions, TommyPrice.com. And It's so far so good. We've done like three projects so far there at my house, drum tracks for other people just remotely, and we got a good little setup.
Remind them again, the hits. You said it was the first was the Warrior, Rebel Yell.
I Hate Myself for Loving You. There's probably a few more little ones in between, but those are the bigger ones. Yeah.
Massive. I mean, how many guys would kill for just one, right?
Yeah. Well, I'd kill for another one right now. I'd do less for one more. Put me back on the map. That was the 80s. This is a little bit different now. It's a little competition. So
don't look at it this way. There's a guy who played something in the 50s, and you think of him as right. It's
like, yeah, that's true. Yeah,
you know
true.
What I mean? Like, he's been on Hound Dog, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There you go. You got a good point.
You know?
Yep. I dig.
Thank you, man. I'm really glad you did this, and thank you, Matt, for helping to make it happen. Tommy, thank you, man.
No problem, man. Thank you.